This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Today we're interviewing Jeff Wilder, the Executive Director of Wolf Haven in Tenino, Washington. Jeff partners with Wolf Haven staff to care for the sanctuary's wolves and find practical ways for humans to coexist with wild wolves. Prior to Wolf Haven, Jeff led creek restoration and erosion control projects on cattle ranches to help landowners conserve their properties. Before that, he directed an ecological research center at the University of California in Santa Barbara. He designed science education programs at the California Academy of Science, and his master's degree was devoted to the mitigation of wolf-livestock conflicts on livestock ranches in areas of recent wolf repopulation. So, Jeff, welcome. It's great to be talking with you. I'd like to find out about Wolf Haven.
Thank you, Jay, for having me.
Okay, so tell us about Wolf Haven. How did it come into being, and what's the idea behind its purpose?
Yeah, so Wolf Haven was founded in 1982 by Steve and Linda Kuntz, and has for its entire history been based in Tenino, Washington, which is just a little bit south of Olympia, the state capital, and about an hour south of Seattle. And it was founded essentially as a space to rescue wolves and wolf dogs that find themselves often in the pet trade, or other, you know, sources that are not great for them, and they need a place to go.
How long has Wolf Haven been operating?
Since 1982.
82, okay, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, and so Wolf Haven's now been in operation for 43 years. In that time,
wow,
we've rescued or provided sanctuary for over 330 wolves and wolf dogs, and many of our current population are not rescues. They're actually part of a federal endangered species recovery program, and those are Mexican wolves and red wolves.
Uh-huh.
And so we have those two distinct populations in our sanctuary.
So, tell me about your team. How many people do you have working there?
Yeah, so we have a staff team of 17 individuals, most of whom are, you know, working inside of our sanctuary in our animal care team, or they are on our education team or conservation team. So we have programs in sanctuary, education, and conservation, and then a couple of admin staff. We also have an army of volunteers that really help us out. We have over 57 active volunteers supporting a lot of our programs. And then we also have 13 individuals who volunteer on our board of directors.
And how many wolves do they take care of?
So in Tenino, at our primary headquarters, we have currently 40 wolves in residence.
Wow.
And we have a second satellite site in Montana that currently supports 16 animals at that sanctuary.
Do you just have wolves, or do you have coyotes or some other kind of canines?
We primarily have wolves and wolf dogs. But we also do have one enclosure in our Washington sanctuary where we house two coyotes. One of them actually just recently passed, so we currently have one live coyote.
Uh-huh.
And so we're not actively seeking to rescue coyotes, but occasionally they do pop up. And if we have space in this particular enclosure, then we'll rescue them. And they do provide a nice opportunity for visitors to kind of better understand the difference between wolves and coyotes.
So what qualifies a wolf to be brought to the sanctuary and taken care of? Have they been injured?
No, they're typically, you know, so we have two populations. We have rescues, and then we have members of the endangered species population. We don't take in any wild wolves into our sanctuary in general. And so the endangered species population, those are typically born in captivity, either at our facility or a partner facility, and we have extremely hands-off protocols for handling them in order to basically help them retain their wild characteristics and potentially become candidates for reintroduction into the wild. Just as an example, just last year in early 2024, red wolf that had been born at Wolf Haven was selected for reintroduction to the Red Wolf Recovery Region in North Carolina. And so we facilitated the transfer of that animal to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which had that animal in an acclimation pen and then released him, his name was Finch, out into the wild in the Red Wolf Recovery Region in eastern North Carolina. And he is doing very, very well. And so it's an excellent example of the great quality of care that we provide our animals and the great opportunity that they have to retain wild characteristics, so they make for good candidates. But so those are just the endangered species population that I just referred to. The majority of our population are animals that are born in captivity, often in the black market pet trade, or potentially coming from zoos or roadside attractions. And often those animals aren't injured so much as sometimes they are abused or come from traumatic private ownership situations. And so when we rescue them, we, you know, are trying to provide them a very safe space for them to, you know, kind of recover from some of their past traumas and just, you know, try to be as wolfy as possible within captivity. And none of those rescues are candidates for release into the wild. They will live the remainder of their lives in captivity here at Wolf Haven.
So what does care involve? What do you have to do to take care of them?
Yeah, so again, we're primarily a hands-off facility, so we do feed our animals, of course, a few times a week, but we don't go into the enclosures to do that. We will distribute raw meat to our animals, and sometimes even a full carcass that we might get donated from a hunter or from a local livestock producer who has donated a deceased animal, and we'll deliver those, you know, typically over the fence. If we can throw them over the fence, we will. If it's something like a carcass, then we will, you know, bring that into the enclosure. But otherwise, we don't really enter the enclosure unless medical attention is necessary. So, of course, our wolves receive really great vet care and really great quality of health care. And so sometimes, you know, we might need to catch up an animal in order to bring that animal into our partnering vet. But that's pretty rare.
So do you employ a veterinary service or veterinarian?
We partner with, they're contractors. Yeah, we partner with local Evergreen Vet here in Olympia. They're fantastic. Their staff is extremely knowledgeable. They've gotten to know our wolves very well, and so they provide really great individualized care for each of our animals.
And when you need to take them out, for example, surgery in a healthy environment, how do you render them in a situation where you can take them out?
Yeah, well, it kind of depends on the animal, and it depends on what they need exactly, but we have a few methods. Sometimes we might be able to just, you know, sedate the animal through the fence, you know, for example, with a dart gun. Other times we might need to actually enter an enclosure. We have a standard procedure for catching up each of our animals safely in a way that is, you know, kind to the animal and also safe for each of our staff members. And so sometimes we'll do that, and then once we've caught up an animal, we can anesthetize them and then get them in a crate to bring them to the vet.
What's the wolf population in the Northwest?
Yeah, so it varies depending on the state. Like, for example, the Northern Rockies area, where the primary core habitat for gray wolves in the Northwest is. You were talking like Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming.
Right.
That region has, I think it's about 1,600 wolves currently in, you know, over 200 packs. Here in Washington State, we have currently, as of the most recent count that was done by the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, we have 230 wolves in Washington, and that's in 43 packs. And then there are also a number of wolves in Oregon and California. And then there's additionally gray wolves in the northern Great Lakes region, so in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan. And then other parts of the country, particularly the desert southwest and in North Carolina, have different species of wolves. There's a subspecies of gray wolf called the Mexican gray wolf that's in Arizona and New Mexico. I think there's currently over a couple hundred wild Mexican wolves in the southwest. And then there are about 20 red wolves in the wild in North Carolina. So the red wolves are the most critically endangered canid species in the world.
So the gray wolf is the most common and abundant species?
in North America, yes, and that is the kind of classic wolf when they're, you know, often depicted in pop culture or in movies. That kind of classic wolf is the gray wolf.
Are the red wolves and the Mexican wolves, are they subspecies, or are they a separate species of wolf?
So the Mexican wolf is a subspecies of the gray wolf, but the red wolf is its own species, Canis rufus, and that species is endemic to the United States. You know, it evolved and lived prior to colonization by European Americans. The red wolf was spread across the whole southeastern United States, basically from Texas. You know, kind of on an arc through the whole southeast all the way to Virginia. And, but that animal, that species has been, you know, along with other wolf species, been dramatically reduced in its range and its total population.
Is there a species difference between wolves that are found in, Russia or Europe as opposed to the gray wolf here in the United States?
Yeah, the wolves that are in Russia or Eurasia, they are classified as Canis lupus, which is the same species as the gray wolf that we have here in North America. But there are, I think, some differences, and there's a lot of kind of disagreements within the wolf biologist world about how best to kind of lump or split the different species designations. And so some people might say that Eurasian gray wolf population is a distinct species. Others might say it's all kind of the same.
Children learn about wolves with fairy tales like Little Red Riding Hood or even Tchaikovsky's Peter and the Wolf, and they have implanted the view of wolves as fearsome creatures. Talk about wolf behavior. Are they as vicious and hostile as they're depicted in those stories?
Right. Yeah, you're pointing to the fact that wolves, you know, in a lot of children's tales are often depicted as villainous and depraved killers. That includes like the story of the three little pigs, and the ones that you've described. So, you know, they're not the most vicious and violent carnivores out there, and they're actually responsible for an extraordinarily small number of attacks on people. You know, and I think in North America, you can actually count on one hand the number of times that a gray wolf has attacked a person in the last 100 years. So it's extraordinarily rare. Certainly, animals like the grizzly bear or the mountain lion or tigers, you know, are much more dangerous towards people and are responsible for many more attacks on people. Personally, I think a lot of the kind of popular vilification of wolves probably comes from not just from the European stories that you just described, but even deeper in time, comes from the fact that, you know, human populations for many thousands of years have been shepherds of different livestock, and wolves, have, I think, for probably all of that time, posed some sort of threat to livestock, things like sheep, goats, even cattle, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think in those ways, humans have for a long time thought of wolves as dangerous to their own livelihood, because if wolves are attacking their sheep, then they're, you know, possibly going to destroy their livelihood. And so that was a consistent problem in history, and it's even a problem right up till today. And so there's a good reason to try to come up with reasons to keep wolves away from livestock. But as far as their threat to humans, it's extremely small.
Wolves, I understand, hang out in packs. And they usually are gregarious that way, and packs are mostly family members. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So you're right. Yeah, packs tend to be actually family groups with a breeding pair that are often the mother and father of maybe some pups, as well as some yearlings that are hanging out. So siblings to the pups. And so, I would say most packs are kind of somewhat smaller. So maybe like, you know, packs can be as small as two individuals, like a breeding pair, but up to maybe, you know, somewhere between 6 and 10 extended family members. Sometimes packs can grow larger than that, but those are pretty rare. But for the most part, yeah, they're family groups. And sometimes you know, individuals might disperse out. So adolescents, once they reach age 2 or 3, individuals may disperse out from their family group and you know, go solo in search of, you know, maybe a mate and potentially founding their own pack.
How do they communicate among themselves?
Yeah, so wolves are very social. You know, I just mentioned they tend to live in family groups, and so therefore they are extremely communicative. They, you know, will communicate by a number of means. I mean, you know, anyone who's familiar with having a dog knows some of the many ways that a canid may try to communicate. You know, that could be, you know, through, you know, vocalizing, howling. Of course, howling is a great feature that many people are familiar with that wolves will do together. And there's a number of different reasons why people speculate they may howl. And then in addition to that, they can, you know, communicate physically by, you know, through touch and play. And then, you know, one really fascinating way that I think wolf biologists, theorize that they communicate is sometimes a lone wolf that's a member of a pack, but is out on its own might encounter, for example, a carcass, which is, you know, a fresh kill or something that, you know, could make for great food for the whole pack that's maybe, let's say, a half mile away. And so that individual might actually rub itself and on the carcass by diving into it on the ground and then run back to the pack. And so that's a form. And so then the rest of the pack will smell the carcass on that individual, and mm-hmm. then he'll bring them all out to the location of the carcass. So that's a communication by smell, and by exploration.
So, were wolves extirpated in Washington, and have come back?
Yes. So historically, you know, again, prior to European-American colonization in North America, there were gray wolves spread across almost all of North America, in every state, other than maybe the Southeast, which was, you know, predominated by red wolves. And so, yeah, there were gray wolf was extremely common across the continent, including in Washington. And then, you know, through especially the 19th century, there was a concerted campaign by settlers and the federal government, the United States federal government, to exterminate wolves. And that campaign was extremely successful, such that by the 1950s, there were really only a small pocket of wolves remaining in the lower 48. Primarily just in the northeastern tip of Minnesota, and then everywhere else in the lower 48 states, gray wolves were gone.
How did they come back into Washington, and did they swim across the Columbia River?
So the population that's in Washington state now is kind of an offshoot of a couple different populations. Basically, in 1995, the United States Fish and Wildlife Service reintroduced 66 wolves into Yellowstone and the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness in central Idaho. So those two locations had reintroduction of gray wolves, and they did very well. That reintroduction was extraordinarily successful, and that's the source population for a lot of the wolves that are now spread across the Rocky Mountain area. And then some of those wolves, that, you know, in Idaho, ended up coming into eastern Washington, and then also meeting a population of Canadian wolves that were coming south into Washington from British Columbia. And so now the wolves that are in Washington are, you know, can basically trace their ancestry back to the reintroduced wolves in Yellowstone and Idaho, as well as the wolves from Canada.
And now wolves are showing up in Oregon and California. How did they get there? Did they swim across the river, or come in from the east?
Yeah, so the wolves that are in Oregon, you know, similar to the wolves that came into Washington from Idaho, wolves in Oregon came in from Idaho as well, and then established there. And then the California wolves have primarily come from Oregon. So, you know, there was a very famous wolf in the early 2010s, I think in 2011, named OR7, who was a radio-collared wolf from Oregon who went on a long journey down into California, spent like a year and a half exploring the Californian wilderness, and then eventually went back into southern Oregon and found a mate and started a pack in the Rogue River region. And then that pack subsequently you know, led to more individuals populating California. So at this point, California now has, I think, about 60 wolves in a few different packs, mostly in the northeastern part of the state, but they're making their way south, even as far down to, I think, the most recent pack discovered in the Southern Sierra, kind of close to Sequoia National Park. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they're establishing very well in all of the Pacific states.
So what's federal policy regarding wolves now?
It's very complicated. They are, you know, in many locations, wolves are still protected by the Endangered Species Act. But that's not the case everywhere. They no longer have Endangered Species Act protections in the Rocky Mountain states, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming. And even in eastern Washington, they no longer have that federal protection because that location, eastern Washington, is considered part of the, at least according to the Endangered Species Act and the federal government, is considered part of that, northern Rocky Mountain region. So they've lost protections there. But they are, in eastern Washington, they are still protected by Washington State's Endangered Species Act. And they're managed by the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife there. But then in the western two-thirds of Washington State, they actually retain protections by the federal government on the Endangered Species Act. And so those populations in like the Cascades, for example, in Washington State, they're managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So, and then each state has kind of other complications. So it's hard to summarize quickly, but that's roughly speaking their status.
And what kind of lethal devices are used to control wolves by ranchers?
Yeah, so again, it's extremely complicated, and the laws vary depending on the state and even the location within the state. So as I was mentioning, Washington has a different management regime in the eastern third compared to the western two-thirds. But in locations where they've lost federal protections, there's a lot looser restrictions. So, for example, Idaho and Montana have hunting available for wolves. So local residents can hunt wolves. That's not yet allowed in Washington, but it's possible that someday, you know, the state may even try to move to do something like that to open up hunting. Currently, livestock producers in eastern Washington, if they see a wolf, if they basically catch a wolf, that's what's called caught in the act of trying to threaten or kill their livestock, then they may be permitted to shoot at the wolf. But again, it's very complicated, and I think any resident of eastern Washington would be able to share a lot more about the various complications with all that. And so, you know, anyone who's maybe interested in learning more, I would certainly encourage you to read up on the law, on the specific laws in your jurisdiction, to find out more.
And does Wolfhaven have a program of relating to ranchers and trying to get ranchers to use non-lethal devices to keep the wolves away?
So in a couple different ways. So one, staff from Wolfhaven have been on the Washington State's Wolf Advisory Group since its founding about 13 years ago. And so what that means is we serve, along with other stakeholder groups, including hunters and livestock producers, we serve on this advisory body that basically convenes many times a year and then makes recommendations to the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife about how the state ought to be managing its wild wolves. So, again, Wolfhaven serves on that advisory body, and we're trying to partner with all of the diverse stakeholders to find a really good pragmatic approach forward for managing wolves in such a way that they don't, cause much conflict with livestock. And then, additionally, we've recently launched a brand new program that's led by Wolfhaven itself called Wolfwise Communities, and this program is focused on southwestern Washington, which is close to where Wolfhaven is based in Tenino. And what we're doing is trying to engage communities in southwestern Washington, which does not yet have wild wolves, but there are a lot of really favorable wolf habitat locations in southwestern Washington. And so it's very possible that in the coming years, wolves could naturally return to southwestern Washington. Essentially descendants of wolves that are currently in the Cascades, could find their way in southwestern Washington. We're talking about areas like around Mount Adams or Mount St. Helens, or maybe even eventually up into the Olympic Peninsula. And so we, Wolf Haven, we're trying to partner with local communities before wolves arrive on the landscape in order to understand what their arrival could mean and how we could anticipate their arrival in order to, you know, develop community collaborations, you know, in anticipation and prevent conflicts in the future.
I believe you have a film called The Trouble with Wolves.
Yes.
Can you tell about that?
Yes. So The Trouble with Wolves is a film that was directed by a director named Colin Monda, and he had put together this great documentary about wolf livestock conflict issues in the greater Yellowstone region, and he also did some filming inside of the Wolf Haven Sanctuary to support that film. And that film is a 1 hour long, really great depiction of the many complex challenges associated with managing wolves on a landscape, on a diverse landscape, and the sorts of conflicts that they can get into with livestock. And so one thing Wolf Haven does is we show that film at free screenings around Washington and even in Oregon and Montana as well. And we'll show that film, and then we'll follow the film up with a live facilitated discussion with everyone in attendance in order to explore those issues more deeply, and including how they relate to Washington State.
And can somebody request that film?
For sure. So if you wanted to see a screening in your community, please reach out to me. You could connect with me by email, which is geoff@wolfhaven.org. That's Jeff with a G at wolfhaven.org. Or you can find our contact information on our website, which is wolfhaven.org.
Wolf Haven solicits visitation, right?
We have visitors in our sanctuary every weekend, Saturday uh-huh. and Sunday. In the summer, we even do Friday morning visits.
Uh-huh.
So folks who are interested in visiting our sanctuary can make reservations on our website. Again, that's www.wolfhaven.org. Visits are by reservation only, so folks would need to go to the website to make that happen. And typically, visits are booked out about maybe month or two in advance. So,
yes.
If you're hearing this now, you know, you'd want to start planning a couple months in advance before coming out.
Is there a charge?
There is a charge. It's a pretty small charge. It's $25 per adult and $10 per child.
Uh-huh.
And there are discounts for seniors and military as well.
Oh, great.
But all of that charge goes to support our operations in the sanctuary. We are a 501c3 nonprofit. We are devoted to, you know, protecting and conserving wolves and their habitat, and also doing education and conservation programs about them. So thank you in advance to everyone who is willing to support us.
Well, Jeff, thank you very much. It's great to talk to you. I have a lot more questions, though, and I'd like to do another session with you, but thanks very much for this half hour. Our guest today has been Jeff Willard, Executive Director of Wolf Haven, a sanctuary down in Tenino, Washington. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or to blissprout.com and see additional features of our website. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Schell.